Days after Zhukov's exile, President Kalinin, who was ill with stomach cancer, started to deteriorate. Stalin personally arranged to send him down to recuperate in Abkhazia, ordering his bodyguards to look after the president tenderly. Yet 71-year-old Kalinin lived with his housekeeper and two adopted children, while his adored wife festered in the camps. Emboldened by his imminent death, Kalinin appealed to Stalin to pardon her. Stalin, Malenkov, and Zhdanov approved the pardon, after she had admitted her guilt, the usual condition for forgiveness. Before he died, on the 24th of June, Kalinin wrote an extraordinary letter to Stalin revealing a secret he had kept for 22 years. In the year after Lenin's death, after the row with Trotsky, Bukharin invited me to his flat to admire his hunting trophies, and asked would I consider ruling without Stalin. I replied, I couldn't contemplate such a thing. Any combination without Stalin was incomprehensible. Stalin headed off on his holiday while Molotov shuttled round the world to attend meetings with the Allies to negotiate the new Europe. In Paris, he defended Soviet interests in Germany while trying to win a protectorate over Libya against the ever-hardening opposition of the Western Allies. Stalin praised Molotov's indomitable defiance. Molotov was very pleased with himself, too. When he found himself relegated to the second row at a French parade, he stormed off the podium, but then wrote to Stalin for approval. "You behaved absolutely correctly," replied Stalin. "The dignity of the Soviet Union must be defended not only in great matters, but in minutiae." Molotov flew on to another session in New York, which Stalin again supervised from Coldstream in Gagra. Stalin cared less about the details of Italian reparations than about Soviet status as a great power. But faced with Ukrainian famine and American rivalry, the cantankerous Vojt sensed dangerous weakness, corruption, and disloyalty around him. While Molotov was triumphant at having signed the peace treaties with the defeated nations, Stalin contrived another humiliation. With the Vojt's blessing, Molotov was offered membership of the Academy of Sciences. He dutifully sent the Academy a grateful cable, upon which Stalin swooped with aquiline spite. "Are you really so ecstatic about your election as an honorary academician? I never thought you could become so emotional about such a second-rate matter. Seems to me that you, a statesman of the highest type, must care more about your dignity." Stalin continued to seethe about the inconvenience of his people starving. Hungry 33 all over again. When even Zhdanov reported the famine, Stalin responded, "They're deceiving you." Yet 282,000 people died in 1946, 520,000 in 1947. Finally, he turned on the supply maestro, Mikoyan, who was clever enough to apologize. "I saw so many mistakes in my work, and surely you see it all clearly," he wrote to Stalin with submissive irony. Like Molotov, Mikoyan's old intimacy with Stalin was over. Khrushchev, his Ukrainian viceroy, fell into disfavor too about his attitude to the famine. "Spinelessness," Stalin upbraided him, and in February 1947 sacked him as Ukrainian first secretary, although he remained premier. Khrushchev collapsed with pneumonia. His name vanished from Ukrainian newspapers. His cult withered. But Kaganovich ordered doctors to treat Khrushchev with penicillin, one of the Western medicines of which Stalin so disapproved. Even if he recovered, was Stalin's pet doomed? In 1947, the American Secretary of State, George Marshall, unveiled a massive program of economic aid to Europe that initially sounded attractive, but Stalin soon grasped that it would resuscitate Germany and undermine his East European hegemony. Stalin and Zhdanov resolved to tighten their control over Eastern Europe. Simultaneously, Stalin supported the foundation of the Jewish state, which he hoped would become a Middle Eastern satellite. Later that year, he would vote for it at the UN, and was the first to recognize Israel. He gave the famous Yiddish actor Solomon Mikhoels, head of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, the Stalin Prize. But it soon became clear Israel was going to be an American ally, not a Russian one. In the cauldron of Stalin's irrational prejudices, razor-sharp political instincts and aggressively Russian sensibilities, Mikhail's dream of a Jewish republic in the Crimea became a sinister Zionist-American Trojan horse. Zionism, Judaism, and America became interchangeable in Stalin's mind. He ordered Abakumov to gather evidence that Mikhail's and the Jewish Committee were active nationalists orientated by the Americans to do anti-Soviet work. Mikhail's played into Stalin's hands by contacting the second most influential Jew after Kaganovich, Polina Molotova. "All power in the country is in Stalin's hands alone, and nobody can influence him," replied Polina. "I don't advise you to write to Stalin. He has a negative attitude to Jews and won't support us." Mikhail's made the tempting but spectacularly ill-timed decision to reach Stalin through Svetlana. Stalin was already brooding about Svetlana's taste for Jewish men. After Kapler, there was Morozov, whom she had married on the rebound from Sergo Beria. "The Zionists have pulled one over you," Stalin told his daughter. Mikhail's, frantic to protect the Jewish community, asked Zhenia Alleluyeva, who mixed with the Jewish intelligentsia, to introduce him to Svetlana. Stalin heard about this immediately and erupted in a rage. The Jews were worming their way into the family. Stalin ordered Abakumov to investigate the Alleluyev connection to American Zionist espionage, muttering to Svetlana that Zhenia had poisoned her husband Pavel in 1938. Shrewd people began to divorce their Jewish spouses. Abakumov started to arrest the Alleluyev's Jewish circle. On the 10th of December, he arrested Zhenia Alleluyeva, once so intimate with Stalin, accusing her of disseminating foul slander about the head of the Soviet government. Zhenia's husband, her vivacious actress daughter Kira, and Anna Redens joined her. Prominent Jews were pulled in and tortured. Goldstein, who had introduced Mikhail's to the Alleluyevs, admitted under interrogation that Mikhail's had asked him to notice all the small details of the relationship between Svetlana and her husband, to inform our American friends. When Stalin read this, it confirmed his worst fears about Mikhail's. Svetlana tried to intercede for the aunties, but Stalin warned her, "They talked too much. You make anti-Soviet comments too." Kira Alleluyeva, Svetlana's first cousin, claims that Stalin warned his daughter, "If you act as their defender, we'll also put you in jail." Both she and Vasily cut the Alleluyev children dead. Meanwhile, Svetlana had divorced Morozov. Stalin started to talk about whom she should next marry, telling his magnates, "She said she'd marry either Stepan Mikoyan or Sergo Beria." Their fathers were alarmed. The Tsarevna did not seem to mind that both boys were not only already married, but in love with their wives. Stalin told the anxious fathers, "I told her neither one nor the other. She should marry Yuri Zhdanov." Simultaneously, this clumsy, tyrannical matchmaker told Yuri to marry Svetlana.